mercenary geologist. I'm bringing a interesting podcast today with the CEO of Monetary Metals, Keith Weiner. And Keith's going to explain a bit about what monetary metals are all about. Of course, it's about gold, and it's based on gold leases and gold bonds. And for this podcast, we're especially interested in gold bonds. And Keith, tell us what you do at Monetary Metals.
We pay interest on gold, and we do that by financing companies that are doing something productive related to gold. In the case of the bond, often it's a mining company that needs capital to get started. We finance them in gold, and we get paid back because they're pulling gold out of the ground, and that's how they repay the mortgage.
And so it's a like to like. It's a payment in kind, if you will, because you're loaning physical gold, and the returns are fit in physical gold with an interest rate. So there's no conversion to dollars. There's no conversion to foreign currencies as Forex ratios change, et cetera. Is that correct?
Well, on the funding side, they liquidate the gold because they're paying payroll and buying diesel fuel and truck tires and those sorts of things. But they've produced physical gold. That's what they do, obviously, for a living. And what's interesting about this, yes, they're matching their income, which is they pull gold out of the ground. They're matching their income to their debt by financing in gold. And that's, a lot of people say, why would anybody want to do this? Gold's going to go up. Wouldn't you be better off financing in dollars, which are falling? But the answer is to match the asset and the liability and take out that currency risk.
Exactly.
And ensure that your mine lives, lives to mine another day, even if the gold price drops a bit.
So in perusing your website, you had an example of a gold bond, and you think it's the last gold bond that was perhaps ever written. Is that correct? And that was from 1905. And going on a second part of that question, when were these first used as financial instruments?
So people have been lending gold. That's funny. Sometimes I get people say, gotcha, your idea isn't new. I'm like, no, you're right. It goes back thousands of years. Gold being money, you lend money to promising enterprises who plan to produce more money or earn more money and repay it back. So this is a very old idea. We're making it new so the bond that we just announced the repayment of was the first gold bond, first proper gold bond. There's been a bunch of things that are gold-backed bonds or gold-linked notes and things like that are basically dollar notes or dollar debt that either the payout varies a little bit with the gold price or there's gold collateral in the background somewhere or something like that. But the first proper gold bond, principal and interest payable in gold, denominated in gold, since 1933 when Roosevelt, destroyed the gold standard. So everything before that was gold bonds. That railroad bond that I took a picture of, I was giving a talk at the Harvard Club in New York. They have all this memorabilia on the wall. And it just caught my eye that here's this old railroad bond from like 1906, 1902, something like that. I took a picture of it. Expired in 1998, I want to say. So it was a 90-plus year maturity, 3.5% interest rate, to give you some idea what the yield curve looked like back in those days. You can read in the fine print right on the bond that said to be payable in, the standard American gold coin. So
right.
They didn't want to be repaid in banknotes, which were gold redeemable in those days.
Exactly.
Pay the real thing. Count out them gold coins on that counter. And so it was $5,000.
$5,000. That kind of tells you what's happened to the value of the dollar, huh?
That's right. Well, so $5,000 was 251 ounce coins.
The gold coins.
right? So at $20 a coin. So you can pick your repayment of that, half a monster box. Like it gives you an idea of the amount of wealth that you could carry easily, maybe not quite in a pocket, but certainly easily in a backpack. And this is a financial instrument bought by an institution. It was bought by Harvard, the Harvard Endowment Fund, to finance a railroad. Now, obviously, the railroad sold other pieces of bond to other investors, but it kind of gives you an idea of the value density of gold was similar then as it is now. Like the amount of gold that you could easily hold in a backpack is a lot of money.
It certainly is.
Then or now.
Exactly. And, because gold retains its value and it has throughout history.
That's right.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about what Roosevelt did, and that tell us about how that affected the ability. Just recap what Roosevelt did, how it affected Americans' ability to own gold, and then what Nixon did in 71 to Ford in 74. And that would lead to a question about is there risk involved with governments with a gold bond? Is there still risk involved? Because there certainly was risk over in the 20th century, let's say.
Right. And of course, they didn't appreciate that risk leading right up to 1933. I don't think anybody really knew what he was about to do. But keeping in mind, in those days, it wasn't a price of gold as much as a standardized unit of account. When you deposited gold at the bank, you weren't selling gold, it was a deposit. And it was abundantly clear to everybody that you had the right to get your gold back and the same amount of gold that you deposited. And all they were doing was standardizing, units. It's like saying on the internet, a byte is 8 bits. And a kilobyte is 1,024 bytes. No one is saying that you're only allowed to send a byte over the internet or how many bytes you're allowed to send. They're just standardizing the packet size.
Right.
What was happening in the Federal Reserve, that's where this story sort of begins. Federal Reserve created in 1913.
Sure.
Leaving aside all of the BS about stabilizing the economy, about employment, about inflation. And those were not contemporaneous ideas. Nobody was thinking about unemployment in 1913 and nobody was thinking about inflation in 1913. Those are ideas today that we project back onto those days because those are our big concerns. But there wasn't structural unemployment. The purpose of a central bank is to let the government borrow and spend more than it otherwise could if it had to live on its tax revenues. And as a side benefit, it also allows their cronies to borrow cheaper than they otherwise could. And sure. Of course, cronies always counted on to support that. So that was the purpose of it, which means they immediately begin putting their thumb on the scales, trying to push interest rates down. Now there's a perversity when you try to manipulate something, the market can often move against you. And so initially they get a rising interest rate. They're trying to push it down, but they don't really understand what they're doing, like a child playing with matches standing in a barn full of dry straw. He doesn't quite get what's about to happen to him. So the interest rate is rising for a bit. And then in the early 1920s, it begins to fall and you have this falling interest rate, which at first creates this wonderful boom. Everybody confuses boom with wealth,
not wealth.
Then you have this horrific crash. Obviously 1929, before deposit insurance and all the other array of moral hazard programs that they've since created, the banks, are dropping like flies. Thousands of banks are failing. So you get to 1933, Roosevelt says, number one, it is illegal, as in felony, as in go to prison, as in today owning certain white powders, go to prison if you're caught possessing it. They will bust down your doors. They will throw flashbang grenades into your bedroom. Maybe they didn't do that in those days, but
I probably didn't have them back then. But
they didn't have flashbang grenades, and the cops were a little bit less militarized, perhaps, in 1933. But it was a felony. Go to prison if you get caught with it. They voided all the gold clauses in contracts that anybody might have had outstanding.
Well, that would include gold bonds.
Bonds, long-term lease agreements on properties, long-term employment agreements, anything that had a gold clause voided. And then, of course, any gold you had deposited in the bank is now just automatically redenominated like some, banana.
In a devalued U.S. dollar, a 60% devalued U.S. dollar, correct?
That's right. He declared that what suddenly becomes a gold price, because it's no longer a contract for, standardizing units of the contract, he devalues from $20 an ounce to $35 an ounce. Correct. If you read the story of this guy, there was some mysticism and some numerology. Why the number 35? And that somehow played to his psychology and his childhood and all kinds of weirdness to that. But he had two purposes fundamentally doing this. So, today you think of buying gold, you go to a third party. It's not a transaction that affects the monetary system. You go to a third party and you buy the gold. And then so someone is selling you that gold and taking possession of the dollars. So from the banking system's perspective, the banks are simply update the name on the record. So, I sell gold to you, which means you give me dollars. So they change the name on the record of those dollars from Mickey to Keith. It doesn't really affect the monetary system. But in those days, that was a withdrawal from the bank.
Right.
That was a run on the bank, which was defunding or, removing capital from the banks. So he wanted to stop the run on the banks. And so that was the first goal of this. The second thing is when people withdraw from the banks in big numbers, that forces the bank to sell assets, to sell bonds. And so selling bonds pushes bond price down, which is the same thing as pushing the interest rate up. And so FDR wanted to lower the interest rate even further than what it already was. And so he had two monetary policy reasons. One, stop the runs on the banks, and two, to get control of the interest rate. Once he did that, and then ended the ability to own gold, changed the banking system to something that nothing to do with gold anymore, then that's over and that's no longer a consideration. So 1971,
a similar thing really happened in 71. There was a run on Fort Knox, which was essentially the large U.S. bank that held gold. That's what happened, right? So it has some similarities.
Yeah, so I was going to say, 1970, what FDR did was he said American citizens cannot redeem their paper dollars for gold.
Right.
However, the window, as it were, was still left open for foreign governments and foreign central banks. So foreign governments, particularly France,
De Gaulle.
But actually, in this case, being smart, not being idiots at all, realized that this was unsustainable, was the problem. They actually sailed a battleship into New York Harbor, offloaded pallets of $20 bills, and unloaded, I imagine, fewer pallets of gold bars.
Yeah, or heavier.
With it.
Yeah.
So the gold is draining out of the treasury. I'm trying to remember. It's been a few years since I've seen the statistic. Hundreds of tons a month, 100 or 200 tons a month, something like that. The U.S., at the end of it, finally had 8,000 tons. So you can imagine 100 or 200 tons a month.
They say 8,537 tons are the official Fort Knox reserve. So
8,500. So anyways, something occurring at a couple hundred tons a month, it's a pretty quick, you can see the end in sight. That's a crisis. So what really gets me about this, everyone thinks Milton Friedman was a free markets guy. Everybody at the time, so there was this crisis, everyone understood gold is being drained because the price was artificially, low at that point. I mean, it was worth more than $35 an ounce. Everybody was dying to get their hands on it. They find 1,000 different little drains to pull it out of.
And only in the U.S. was it actually $35 an ounce. The rest of the world, it was much higher.
That's right. The U.S. is continuing this pretext for a bit longer. And everybody around the U.S., like the monetary cognoscenti, as it were, thought that what Nixon would do was the same thing that what FDR did, which is reprice it or devalue the dollar, and that that would fix the problem. In fact, Samuelson, who's the author of the awful Keynesian macroeconomic textbook that every kid
Paul is Samuelson, right?
That's right. He already had a article, you know, penned for the Washington Post, you know, talking about how Nixon, you know, devalues the dollar, and they just were just waiting for the new price. They could plug it in and print the paper. Friedman was whispering in Nixon's ear and said, just default altogether, just declare the window to be closed. And that's what Nixon did. And anybody who hasn't seen it, it's on YouTube. You should Google Nixon, August 15, 1971, gold default. Well, you know, I've directed Secretary Connolly to temporarily close the gold default. And
I am not a crook, right?
That's right. So anyway, so after he does that, the dollar no longer has anything whatsoever to do with gold. And which means gold no longer matters. So it takes them a few years, because Nixon said temporary, so everyone figured, you know, gold maybe is going to come back. You know, that happened before in the Civil War. You know, there are these periods where you leave metal, but you come back to it. Nobody was really sure what was going on. You get to 1975, and it's clear it's not coming back. Gold is done. So that no longer does anybody care. So Congress passes a law to legalize it. And subsequent to that, they reallow gold clauses and all kinds of other things. And they said, you know what? Throw it on the futures market. Treat it like orange juice, frozen orange juice and pork bellies. And they even joked, oh, yeah, it'll probably go down to $7 an ounce.
It went to $175 in 1975.
They didn't care anymore. And the more it goes up, the more people pay capital gains. And as long as gold has no link to the monetary system, they don't care. They were interested in controlling the banks, controlling interest rates, controlling monetary policy. Gold no longer has anything to do with that. Now it's unrelated third-party transactions. And so what we're doing falls outside their area of concern. They're interested in manipulating dollar interest rates ever lower. And you look at the dislocations that are going on now, their only policy response, the same as the previous policy response, the same as the one before that and the one before that, lower the interest rate. And as long as they get control of the interest rate, they're fat, dumb, and happy. And GDP moves up and asset prices move up and everyone says.
And the CPI supposedly goes up 2% a year. Now it'll go up more this year. But we all know that inflation is probably somewhere around 13-14% on an annualized basis right now. If you use the CPI or the inflation calculation, the way they did it in 1980, or even the way they did it in 1990, we're looking at 13-14% year over year right now. Go to the gas pump, go to the grocery store. I talked about last Friday in my weekly podcast about inflation, stagflation, shrinkflation nation, and that's what the U.S. is becoming right now, or the world, really. It's actually more than.
And I don't think the Fed cares. I think they're an enabler for government borrowing. And the other prime mission that they have is to ensure that the major banks remain solvent. But to do that, they have to make sure that most debtors, that the marginal debtor is able to at least continue to service his debts. Because everybody starts defaulting, the banks become insolvent very quickly. So it's really about making sure, you know, there's the line from Dune, the spice must flow, you know, the debt service must flow. Which means everybody needs, every farmer, every miner, every manufacturer, every truck driver needs to get enough revenues that net of their expenses that can service their debts.
Yep.
That's what the Fed cares about. And if that means consumer price inflation, you know, so be it. Damn the torpedoes.
Yeah.
Is what I think that they would probably say.
Well, I think we've exhausted our review of what the government has done over the last, well, what's it been now? 108 years. Yeah. Let's go on and focus on your company, Monetary Metals. And we've alluded to the fact that you just completed and paid your investors for the first successful gold bond since Roosevelt closed the the ability of American stone gold in 1933. So let's talk a little bit about what you did and how that worked and how your investors walked away quite happy.
So, you know, and as I said earlier, I mean, the idea is old, like thousands of years old. So in that sense, nothing new there. What I think is different today is in the current environment, to stand up as I did when I, you know, launched this business and said, I want to pay interest on everybody's gold. I want it to be possible for everybody with gold to deposit their gold in an interest.
Right. And that's one of the big negatives that's promulgated in mainstream media and people like the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett, that gold is worthless because it doesn't return on investment. In That's other right. words, it doesn't return interest rate. So it's not, so sorry to interrupt, but go right yeah. ahead.
He's made a lot of comments about gold over a lot of years.
Yeah.
It kind of strikes me as like just a, you know, a child poking an anthill with a stick, taking a certain pleasure in disturbing the ants. Like he's poking the gold community with all of these comments. And the problem is he's a very smart guy. The problem is he's right on the face and disingenuous as hell at this both at the same time. So he's correct in saying gold has no utility. It's not procreative nor productive. You buy a lump of gold, you stick it in your drawer. 20 years later, you take it out. It's the same lump of gold, blah, 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 blah. All of which is true superficially.
But it's retained its value.
Right. That's the disingenuous as hell. He's acting as a shill for the Fed and its monetary madness.
To devalue dollars incrementally through inflation.
And this is where, you know, the U.S. was not a country built on class envy and class warfare the way, you know, certainly endemic in Europe. You know, the U.S., everybody was happy to let other people go and do their thing, even if other people were richer or whatever. But what Buffett is showing here, not to pick on him, because I think most people who own assets are kind of smug about it. They're like, hey, you know, here's the nature of the game. Yeah, Buffett would say, you're right. The currency is losing, you know, value at 2% or 5% a year, whatever. You're right. That's true. I don't think he would deny that. And therefore, the thing is, you got to own the right assets to go up, which go up a lot faster than inflation.
Exactly.
So very smug. And of course, if you can own those assets on borrowed capital, on credit, it's an even better deal because the cost of your credit is always going down. The price of your assets is always going up. So he's very smug and, you know, look at, I did all this. The problem is, number one, there's a lot of people who don't have the, you know, financial market savvy to play that game and the risk tolerance and all the rest that goes with that. And number two, it should be obvious that an entire country can't get rich by all jumping in and speculating on, you know, whatever, that's ultimately becomes Ponzi finance.
For every trade, there's a winner and a loser, so.
Yeah, and so, you know, he's showing he's very smug about all this and then missing the broader point, which is why I say it's disingenuous, that, you know, people are owning gold. Well, a lot of people say, well, gold's gonna go up, but I think that the main reason for owning gold as a way of opting out of this system that Buffett is saying, don't opt out, join me. You know, together we can drive asset prices up even more. And a lot of people are just like, I want to opt out. And of course, gold being money, money's not an investment. Money's what you own when you don't want to buy anything else. And so anyways, so to monetary metals, we're saying that money, one of the things money does is investable. Money should be able to generate a return in the form of more money, always did. We just live in this short little window where the world's gone mad and thinks it's no longer true. And the answer is it is still true. It still makes sense. Makes sense for the borrower because it gets rid of a currency risk problem for them. It makes sense for the lender because if you think owning gold is a good deal, even when you're paying 75 basis points a year for storage, it's an even better deal if you're getting interest on it.
Which segues into your bond that you've just completed. So let's get in the details of that.
So the bond was to finance a gold loan to a mining company in Western Australia called Shine Resources. Uh-huh. For those who really know the geography of that area, they're outside of Kalgoorlie.
Yes.
I never know if I'm pronouncing that right or not.
That's Kalgoorlie, that's it.
When you listen to
minus the Aussie accent, so
well, obviously when you listen to the Australians pronounce it, it comes out pretty different to my ear.
So does every word they say. I had a friend.
They're outside of that goldfield district there, and they had a whole bunch of good dirt. They had everything all permitted, ready to go. They had done the geology and all the everything down to the geotechnicals of what kind of pit wall you could do and how steep and all that. Bunch of serious professionals, in our opinion. They needed some money to start production. And we obviously lent that to them. We funded the loan by, parceling it out and selling this securities offering, which is this the thing that we call the bond, denominated in gold, principal and interest repaid in gold. And that was the proof of concept that the whole thing, you know, actually works. Very interestingly, I want to say it was within a couple of weeks after we announced that we had repaid that bond in full with interest, that announcement came out from Coinbase. So Coinbase, I don't know if they are the leading cryptocurrency company, or certainly one of the leading ones, announced that they're borrowing $1.5 billion US dollars. And everyone's sitting here saying, well, that proves the validity of crypto. And I'm like, they're borrowing dollars. Think about it, take as long as you need. Crypto cannot be used to finance productive enterprise. It's a bet that the price will go up, and it might be really good for doing that, fulfilling that role, but it's not capable of financing anything. And if one of the leading crypto companies demonstrates that they agree with me and finances themselves in dollars, I just thought that was a really interesting, you know, footnote to our, you know, transaction.
Let's talk about the term and the interest rate and the payback. They paid the loan back ahead of time. So tell us how that all turned out.
So term was a year. The expected schedule was to be just a bit less than a year anyway. They ran into a couple of challenges that I guess I would call reasonable and customary in the business. The first one is trying to staff up with their labor in January. And I haven't seen it personally, but I can believe it. But what I've been told is that a lot of the laborers out there basically go away on some sort of Christmas holiday and drink as much as they can and keep drinking.
Well, that's the Aussie way, so.
And they keep drinking until basically they're out of money, and then they have to sober up and get a job again. And so staffing up was a bit slower than.
So I don't think we need to go into the details of it. What I want to know, for our listeners' purposes, and I know it already, but let's talk about the loan, the term, and the interest rate that you paid your investors and how that worked.
So the loan size itself was in the vicinity of a little over 3,000 ounces. So we always think in ounces. And then everyone says, well, how many dollars is that?
Well, the dollar can go up and go down.
So that was
value goal remains the same.
You know, 6 million US dollars roughly at the time. Price of gold's come back, off since then. Interest rate to investors is 13% on drawn amounts. So there was a reserve set aside. Normally, we say to people, for our leasing program, a lot of people say, wait, how does this work? My gold sits in the vault and you pay me for it? I'm like, no, it doesn't work that way. There's no such thing as getting paid to have your gold sitting in a vault. In the case of the reserve, actually, the investors were paid to have the gold sit in the vault, but it was callable. So you're really being paid for the for the call rate that the borrower could call if they needed to, but for the amounts that were drawn, the rate was 13%.
Nice. 1 year, 13%.
It's a nice rate. In gold, so you don't have to worry about trying to adjust that for inflation. I've written a lot about this. I don't think it's as simple as subtracting CPI from an interest rate, but clearly if the money's being debased and all you do is you get interest roughly equal to the rate of debasement, clearly you're on a treadmill that's being cranked backwards. You're not necessarily making any headway and you could actually be falling behind. And in gold, you don't have that problem. Gold can't be debased by definition. I categorically reject the idea that gold mining is inflation. Some monetarist purists attempt to assert that. And I'm like, no, it's not inflation.
Okay, so you've established a proof of concept with your first gold bond. You're going to do more for my audience and myself who are interested in a gold bond as a financial instrument. Give us an idea. So if I put 100 ounces of gold into your first offering, I would have gotten 113 ounces of gold back when the bond was completed in a year, correct?
It was a bit less than that because it was less than a year. And some of the gold wasn't drawn. So some of it was sitting in the vault earning a lower interest rate.
I see.
But I don't have the number offhand, but you got a bunch of it. You had a lot more than 100 ounces at the end of the year.
Right, yeah. Right. And so tell us how this works. In previous conversations I've had with you, investor needs to be accredited in the U.S., which means you need, correct me if I'm wrong, net assets outside of your principal domicile of $1 million. And is this a gold only transaction? So do I send gold to you or do I send dollars? When it's completed, can I get my gold out of your vault, or give me some idea about how this all works?
So a bunch of good questions. To participate in our lease program, you do not have to be accredited. Leases have much lower interest rates and obviously very different risk profile.
Give me some range on the leases. What would that amount to?
Roughly 2-3% a year.
Okay.
But no credit risk. Gold is always physically present and audited and verified to be there. A lease is a very different animal than lending money to a gold mine. Right. But anyway, 2-3% interest, which a lot of people may not be interested in. Other people may be interested in because it's lower risk. So that's what makes a market interesting, is people have their preference where they tend to want to go. But for the bond, absolutely, you have to be accredited. We're working on, in the future, we want to try to address that. We want to make this available to everybody, but that's right now what it is. So to be accredited in the United States, the SEC defines it as $1 million net worth, not including your house.
Right.
Or there's a bunch of other ways to get accredited status. $200,000 income if you're unmarried, or $300,000 income if you're married filing jointly with your spouse. There's a bunch of other things, but those would be your basic ones. We do accept delivery of physical gold. We have a network of vaults around the world that we partner with that depending on where you are, we'll say, okay, this is the closest one that makes the most sense. We'll give you a shipping label for shipping that and a packing list. So you can only put so many ounces of gold in a box before you're hitting shipping, insurance limits and things like that.
Right. I think it's about 50 ounces now.
Yeah. So we'll steer you, steer you straight on that. Or if you have dollars, we can, broker for you to buy gold to get in and participate that way. At the end,
when is it U.S. investors only at this stage, or
no? It's global.
Okay.
We have plans globally.
Okay.
At the end, it's a very important feature that people have the right of physical redemption, obviously they have to pay fabrication costs for whatever product they want, and shipping costs to get wherever it is they want to go. But you can, or you can walk up to the vault if you happen to be close by, and physically take possession of it. And we occasionally have people do that. But that physical redemption is, I think, the essential feature of the gold standard.
Right, exactly. So let me give you a couple of examples. I know you're based in the Phoenix area, Scottsdale specifically. Do you have a vault in, say, the Western U.S. that you store at, or the Rocky Mountains, or?
Yeah, we have a couple. So we're partnered with both TDS, which is a subsidiary of A-Mark, and so they have Las Vegas and they have L.A. We also have a Brinks Global account, so that gives us Salt Lake City and. Remember,
so that would be what used to be Johnson Matthey, I presume. Is that right? Or they were a gold refiner, certainly. So
is the Brinks facility, was it purchased? I couldn't tell you.
Okay. Suffice it to say, you have a, so let's use a, for instance, say I want to participate in your next gold bond and I ship you PAMP gold bars. 1 ounce gold bars.
Right.
Do I have the right when it's paid off to take my balance with interest, but my original investment? Could I have those re-delivered to me as PAMP gold bars and forego the cost of refabrication?
Generally not. So everything that comes in, we're going to want to convert it to a bulk bullion, you know, basically allocated pool, which makes it fungible and easy to deal with.
Like so one of those big 400 ounce bars or something like that, right?
There's a stack of 100 ounce bars, and everybody has kind of a piece of that. But then it allows us to deal in fractions of an ounce and all kinds of other things, depending on what product you send in and depending on where we are in the cycle. There's often a premium for products like that. So you actually, if you sent 100 of those 1 ounce bars, you'd probably get more than 100 ounces of pool. Although there is the loss that you're talking about is the bid-ask spread. So when you convert bars to pool, you get something, probably not as much as what you paid. And then when you convert pool back to bars, you have to pay more for the bar than what we were able to get when we liquidated it.
Okay.
A little bit of loss there. Obviously, in a 13% interest bond deal, you still come out ahead, but it does take a little bit of the edge off of it.
Right.
This makes more sense as if you're planning on being in the program for more than just one deal for 1 year.
Right. So what's the minimum investment for an average retail investor like myself? Is there a minimum that you accept?
Yeah, the minimum is 10 ounces.
10 ounces. So at current price, $17,500 worth of gold. Okay. Now that sounds very reasonable. So, and for those interested, and folks, I'm certainly interested in this. It's a way that I see that gold I've got stashed hither and yon for a way to me to make some interest on my gold. When do you have an idea? I know you're working on various bonds right now. When do you have an idea when the next one would be offered, or the next? You've provided proof of concept. I know you're going to want to test the scalability of this going forward. So do you have a way that investors can express their interest, sign up to get on perhaps a president's list or a list to be notified, or are they announced via your website? How will that work going forward?
So we have to be a bit careful on the leases. We can talk about it openly on the bonds because we have all the securities regulation to be very mindful of. I want to be careful not to solicit.
Absolutely.
In this conversation. But yes, if you come to our website, you can sign up, you can get on our mailing list, and you can enter a comment and you can say, I'm interested in this stuff. And that will be, you know, certainly duly noted. We've got a number of, products planned, for the near to intermediate, future, including obviously leases, which we're doing at a regular clip right now. And also we have some bonds planned that are not for mining companies, but for other kinds of companies.
I see. Other companies involved in some segment of the gold industry to start with?
Yeah, you've got to be involved in gold somewhere. Otherwise, it'd be crazy for you to borrow gold, and we're not going to help.
Point well taken. Kind of a dumb question, I guess.
But actually, there's a really important principle there, which is, borrowing gold could effectively be a short position on gold. We get that question from a lot of concerned people. I've seen it on Twitter any number of times. If you're running a hamburger stand and you're borrowing gold to finance your hamburger stand, effectively, it's giving you two things. It's financing your hamburger stand, and it's a short bet.
On gold, exactly.
Well, if you want to bet that the price of gold is going to go down, then have at it. But we don't want anything to do with that trade, and we don't want to enable anybody who's playing in that trade. So it's, or if we lend to a gold mining company, yes, they're selling it, but it's not a short position in gold because it's a hedge position. They're actually long gold in the ground. And as long as they know what they're doing, and as long as the ground really has gold in it, the gold will come out of the ground.
Yep.
So we don't want, to help any kind of synthetic short kind of play.
Right. You're long.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we believe in gold, and I have my own money in gold anyway. But it's just also kind of it's a suicide trade. It's one of the, I guess the expression used to be picking up pennies in front of a steamroller. Like for quite a while, you can think that you're being really smart and making money, but you're only making small bits of money here and there. And then there's the catastrophic failure at the end. So it's not a good long-term strategy.
Right. Okay. Well, I appreciate your time and the knowledge that you have given not only me but my many listeners. Folks, if you're interested in knowing more about what Keith is doing, why don't you give us your website? And I presume on your website there's a contact us and explain that.
There's all that stuff, and then there's a place you can sign up to receive our mailings and all that.
Right.
So the website is monetary-metals, that's plural, metals.com. And then, there's a lot of blog stuff, there's a lot of charts about the gold market, some unique things that we're calculating. I don't think there's any other source for. And then my commentaries about macroeconomics and events,
right,
inflation and
monetary science, et cetera. Right.
That's it. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for your time, Keith. It's been enjoyable. And I'm certainly going to follow up on this idea. And best of luck going forward.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Mickey.
All right. Thanks, folks, for listening. Bye for now.